It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the interrelated conflicts in Syria and Iraq. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On our last Middle East Encounter program, we spoke in cautiously optimistic terms about the outcome of the Iraqi elections. Since then, the situation has devolved into chaos and violence. Extremists from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, who now pretentiously call themselves the Islamic State, have seized significant territory in parts of northwestern Iraq. The Iraqi army barely put up a fight. The Kurds, on the other hand, prevented ISIS from taking over the disputed oil-rich city of Kirkuk and will not, in all likelihood, give up their control, to the chagrin of Baghdad. The ISIS onslaught in Iraq has aggravated the country's sectarian divisions and challenges the entire regional geopolitical landscape, let alone the territorial integrity of Iraq. On this edition of the program, we will examine the interrelationship between the conflicts in Syria and Iraq, and for more on the internal and external factors that led to this state of affairs, what options exist to turn the tide, as well as the U.S. role, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Jessica Lewis is research director at the Institute for the Study of War, that's a research organization based in Washington. Prior to joining ISW, Jessica served in Iraq and Afghanistan as an intelligence officer for the U.S. Army. And Faisal Itani, he's resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based here in Washington. Before joining the Atlantic Council, he worked as a political and economic risk analyst. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both. Jessica Lewis, let me begin with you. Let's do a sit rep, as we say, talking about the situation, particularly in Iraq right now, where we note that the parliament met, hoping to form some kind of a consensus government. They adjourned without success. The United States has said it wants to help Iraq, but they need to see a political move towards some kind of consensus to include the Sunnis. Talk about where we stand today, both politically and militarily, in Iraq.
Well, I think politically and militarily, we are observing a disconnect between Baghdad and the rest of Iraq, particularly those regions that are currently under direct threat of ISIS in the north and the west and the east. Moving from north-south, beginning with Mosul and several of the cities in the immediate vicinity, ISIS is in control, but the main front line of Iraqi security force counteroffensive against ISIL has been in the central provincial capital of Tikrit, which is also Saddam Hussein's hometown. So as we look at the political conditions, I actually expect that everything that has happened this week is actually symptomatic of a general fear that ISIL is still on the offensive, and there's a lack of confidence for many parties that there will be a unified political solution. I think many are actually looking for that, which will provide best for security.
Indeed. Turning to you, Faisal Itani, to add or subtract to what Jessica said, we talk about ISIL, ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. Talk about this group. How is it that they have made such headway into Iraq? And why has the Iraqi government been unable to address politically the situation in order to form a government that could repel ISIS?
You know, they've been able to make progress in both Syria and Iraq for, I think, separate reasons. In Syria, it's mostly because their most powerful potential rival, which is the Syrian state, isn't prioritizing fighting them in the areas they control for a number of strategic reasons as well as tactical. The weakness of its rebel rivals has also been key. Of course, it has been in a months-long conflict with rebel groups in Syria, one that it has managed to do relatively well in. It has held on to what it sees as its core areas, as well as energy assets and other sources of financing in the country's north and east. In Iraq, it's been a somewhat different dynamic, and you could argue an even more successful one, because what they've done in Iraq is exploit deep well of Sunni resentment against what is seen as a Shia-dominated government, perceived as aligned with Iran. In this sense, they've been able to tap into something to a much broader sentiment than the one they have in Syria. In Syria, those who wish to resist the regime have options, and the revolution there, the opposition, has taken on a sort of hyper-local form. So therefore, there are many different currents aiming towards some of the same broad ends, but there isn't much cooperation. In Iraq, they've managed to cast themselves as a sort of tip of the spear of what is actually a broader Sunni insurgency that's mobilizing elements of society far beyond the group's ideological core. When it comes to Baghdad itself and the central government, it appears there is something particular about Prime Minister Maliki's worldview that makes him very distrusting towards the political community of Sunnis. I'm not going to say all Sunnis. For him, a lot of this has simply reinforced what he always thought were his worst fears about intransigent collaboration between former Baathis, between Sunni tribes, and between the jihadists. And for him, it's further proof that at the end of the day, they can't be trusted and they're not partners in a common political project. The problem is for him is he's not really incentivized right now to find a solution. A, he spent the past few years entrenching himself in Iraq's security and government institutions, and therefore he's going to be difficult to uproot. And he knows the Iranians would prefer not to rock the boat so much at a time of acute crisis and sort of reshuffle Iraq's political configuration. So in a sense, he's called the United States' bluff and his rival's bluff within Iraq, and hey, he's still here. One of the things we've seen about these sort of minority or sectarian-based regimes, more accurately, is that once they're under crisis, they sort of get whittled down to their core, which is sort of group of sectarian militias supporting what is supposed to be a state army, but what's really made up of a core of loyal officers.
So he doesn't see himself as part of the problem. He doesn't see that he may have helped to persuade some of these Sunni tribes in Iraq to make a marriage of convenience with ISIS because he did not basically address their grievances or bring them into the government earlier on.
I don't think he does. I don't think constitutionally and his worldview and his political temperament made him question, what did I do wrong when this happened? He's seen this as part of a long-running process he's been fighting against. He sees it in a sectarian and terrorism terms. And for him, the last straw is anybody who's jumped to the other side and sided with ISIS. He does, however, still feel that there are a group of fence-sitters or sort of disloyal, tentative allies of ISIS that he can still bring over to his side, whether that's through the country's tribal structures or whether it's through former government, former military persons. So he hasn't ruled that out yet. It's not black and white for him.
Turning back to you, Jessica Lewis, I want to go back to my premise, which is there is a relationship between the situation in Syria and Iraq vis-a-vis the onslaught of ISIS. How do you see the intertwining of the rebellion in Syria and the insurgency in Iraq? Do you think that the U.S. and Western inaction vis-a-vis supporting the secular opposition, maybe going back a couple of years, that is in Syria, and foregoing airstrikes to punish Bashar al-Assad for using chemical weapons, and in exchange decided to take up the offer of the Russians to eliminate Syria's chemical weapons in exchange for not striking, which ironically empowered rather than weakened Bashar al-Assad. To what extent did our actions or inactions in Syria bring us to this day, coupled with the marginalization of Sunnis in Iraq, who are now aligning themselves, even if just for tactical reasons, with ISIS?
I think my primary answer to that question is actually one that I drew from a lesson from the original U.S. Army's experience in Iraq fighting ISIL's predecessor organization, AQI. And that lesson was that a successful campaign against AQI really required the full mobilization of the Sunni tribes against AQI. So as we translate this to the broader question about how the Syrian war is like the circumstance that is unfolding into one in Iraq, and how the secular opposition's position in Syria really does give rise to a stronger ISIS, I think it is very much a similar dynamic where the secular opposition in Syria is fighting two enemies. It's fighting ISIL, it's fighting the Assad regime. And so also on the Iraq side, we have a Sunni population that has to make choices. At the moment, it's facing an extremely capable military enemy in ISIL. This military enemy not only knows the terrain from a perspective of AQI, but I also think that among their leadership corps, driving this military campaign for ISIL are members of the former regime's military. From the perspective of a Sunni whose city has just been taken over in northern Iraq, the choices, again, look like two fronts. You have an enemy in ISIL, but you also have an enemy in the Iraqi state, which very much, as was mentioned prior, has not just been politically limiting to opportunities for the Sunnis, but has also been on the offensive against the Sunni population, or at least this is the way it is perceived, such that if an Iraqi security force moves into a Sunni village and rounds up all of the people inside and arrests them, then this very much makes the Iraqi security forces look like the enemy of the Sunni people. So the dynamic that I really think does unify, despite the fact that ISIL is also in both countries, is that the Sunni populations on both sides that have a secular grievance that would mobilize them to war against their governments are fighting two enemies, their governments and also ISIL, and that really compromises them in the end as an essential key ingredient to a counter-ISIL strategy.
Well, a follow-up to you then is the United States' role. Now, the U.S. has pledged $500 million now to help the so-called moderate opposition in Syria to fight both ISIL as well as the regime. Do you see this as perhaps too little, too late? To what extent could that help, if it had come earlier, somehow may have prevented ISIL from moving so quickly into Iraq? Just trying to understand why we got where we are today and to what extent this kind of aid is going to be effective.
It's not over yet. So I think that the aid that is provided to the secular opposition in Syria has a very good chance of having a counter effect against ISIL. I do think that more provided earlier would have exploited a greater vulnerability for this growing organization, and time is working against us in both countries. The stronger that ISIL becomes because it is in control of terrain, which allows it, among other things, to seize more military equipment, to break more potential fighters out of prisons, to get more money out of banks, to expand their territory and get access to more external borders. I mean, the organization grows stronger over time. So as we look at what it has done for the Syrian opposition to counter ISIL, I still see that there are opportunities. This is still the force that pushed ISIL out of Aleppo and Idlib just a few months ago. There are major pockets of resistance against ISIL in territory that ISIL really wants to control on the Syrian side. That fight is not over. But what complicates it very much is as the United States tries to figure out what to do to complement that on the Iraq side. A lot of the policies still very much are trying to engage the Iraqi government as legitimate. I think it is correct to say that a unified Iraq is a principal goal in order to sustain regional stability, but that means working with the Iraqi government, whose security forces are perceived as Shia militia when they are literally integrated, and a sectarian force that is sponsored by Iran. Providing airstrikes to that force has the potential to look like supporting an Iranian axis, including Maliki and Assad, against the Sunnis, which doesn't quite add up with the policy to support the secular opposition in Syria. So the gap that I really see needs to be filled in U.S. policy is one that creates a unifying force for the Sunni inside of Iraq as well that are willing to fight ISIL and make their efforts synergistic with other forces in Iraq so that this is sustained as an Iraqi effort to counter ISIS. I think that's necessary for ISIS at all to be disrupted, if not defeated.
Back to you, Faisal Itani, to talk about, you know, the strategy. I mean, here we are in a situation where the Iraqi government, Maliki, not getting the kind of help he wanted from the United States, has turned now to Iran and Russia. Iran and Russia have filled the breach with weaponry, with advisors. Ironically, the United States finds itself, in a sense, on the same side because everybody is supposedly against ISIS. But again, the ultimate paradox is the fact that the reason why ISIS, or one of the reasons why ISIS has grown so strong, is because of the presence of Bashar al-Assad, who is a magnet, of course, for these jihadi groups who want to destroy him. He is now also helping Iraq. Where does this leave the United States? And do you think the U.S. is right in conditioning aid to Iraq, to Maliki, on a new political formation that would be more inclusive, which doesn't look like it's ever going to happen, at least anytime soon? And what about this very late, but nonetheless fairly substantial aid to the Syrian rebel opposition. How do you see this?
You know, the situation the United States has found itself in with Maliki is sort of comic and really tragic, because he is one of the people, if not the person, that the United States was insistent remain sort of linchpin of the Iraqi political structure ahead of their withdrawal. Perhaps they felt that he wasn't as bad as he turned out to be, or perhaps they felt that anything was better than reshuffling the deck in Iraq in the lead-up to a U.S. withdrawal. Obviously, he's turned out to be part of the problem. The problem is here now that the United States doesn't actually have as much leverage as it would like to think against al-Maliki. The Iranians are not stepping in to fill a breach, in my opinion, as much as they are doing what comes most naturally and best to them. They've used a model in Syria to prop up the regime that they feel has worked relatively well. I mean, it hasn't achieved all its objectives, but it has preserved the core of a regime in an important strategic area, as well as its sort of geographic, economic, and military infrastructure. Now in Iraq, which is infinitely more important geopolitically to Iran than Syria is, they are using or are likely to use much the same model. Whatever the United States does, and it is my belief that as long as the United States does not have a substantial presence in Iraq, the Iranians will always have the upper hand here. So it seems like there aren't really many good options in Iraq. I think, and this leads to your second question, the options in Syria are much more palatable, because in Syria, you have a broad-based insurgency that is already fighting ISIS.
Are you talking about the Free Syria Army?
The mainstream opposition. Mm-hmm. And you have a regime that, unlike in Iraq, I mean, the troubling thing about Iraq is the regime is an actual partner, ostensibly, whereas Assad is quite clearly a rival, and this regime is not something we've pledged to protect. Which brings us to the $500 million. Is it enough? No. In terms of in absolute resources, no, it's not nearly enough. The bright side of the balance of power in Syria is that everybody in there is really weak, and that includes the regime, Hezbollah, the various Free Syria Army brigades, indeed, even ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra by absolute terms. But the problem is that ISIS is that much stronger than its proximate rivals in the moderate opposition. They have a huge resource advantage, and they also benefit from not being bombarded and starved daily by the regime. This resource advantage has to be offset, and $500 million is not going to do it. Also, the moderate opposition has to be able to consolidate some sort of normalcy and control over the areas it occupies. It hasn't been able to do that. And if it doesn't do that, it cannot fight on two fronts. And for it to do that, it has to find a way to kill regime armor and, frankly, counter regime airstrikes. And I know this is a whole other hot topic, but the truth of the matter is if they don't have an anti-aircraft capability, they can win against neither ISIS nor the regime. The worrying thing about this package is I haven't seen any detail about what exactly it is or what it's exactly it's supposed to achieve. Now, it is comforting that it's a substantial increase in material support, but other than that, I'm wondering whether it's the administration ticking a box or whether it is actually the start of a strategic shift. I'm skeptical.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Jessica Lewis, Research Director at the Institute for the Study of War, a policy group based here in Washington, and Faisal Itani, from whom you just heard. He's resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based think tank. We're discussing the relationship between the conflicts in Syria and Iraq, the causes and consequences of the expansion of the terrorist group ISIL, which now calls itself the Islamic State. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Gimba Solomon, from Kaduna State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us if you listen to the show via radio or the internet. Well, back to you, Jessica Lewis. Ironically, would you say that if not Saudi Arabia or Qatar or other governments in the region, to what extent have maybe private citizens in these countries financed jihadi groups that have allied themselves with ISIL and, in effect, helped to exacerbate the problem?
The Syrian discussion of support to extremist groups fighting in that country had long involved the activity of private donors who either didn't necessarily care exactly to follow where their funds went or, in fact, were ideologically aligned, that this was a significant factor. But I think really as we look at ISIL now and its core strength, which I also view as having accrued in Iraq while all of us were focused upon Syria, I think that this group's core strength is stabilized and growing because it is already successful. This organization develops its own money, and that having money now is something that it can use in order to reach out to future donors, in order to reach out to future professionals whom they are now encouraging to emigrate.
Let me turn now to Faisal.
I'm going to echo what Jessica said and basically say that ISIS is now more or less self-sufficient, not completely, but it's generating its own funding streams, and the role of foreign private funding now is much less significant than it was at the beginning of the group's activities.
It's incredible how they've been able to, through either criminal activities or seizing territory,
sure,
oil wells, I guess, they are now self-sufficient.
Sure, and what they would call as a state taxation. So that's not something I think the Saudis, the Qataris, etc. can impact significantly on. You would think that they would be in a panic about what's been happening in Iraq, and I'm sure they're concerned. The Gulf states seem more concerned. What they're using is as sort of like an I told you so to the United States. This is, you know, the price of letting Maliki wreak havoc in Iraq and not stopping Assad is now you have these ISIS guys. And as they see it, they're happy to let that pressure build up for now.
They may have a point in a way, though, even though it's not constructive. But as we look back, again, Monday morning quarterbacking, one could argue, but how much influence did the United States or others have over Maliki to be more inclusive? I'm sure they told him to do so. And as you said earlier, he's not much of a statesman or introspective. At the same time, many critics of the U.S. policy or Western policy vis-a-vis Syria have said, had we helped the moderate opposition in Syria a long time ago or when the red line was announced or even in 2012, perhaps they could have helped not only defeat or put Assad on the defensive, but also fight against the more extremist elements.
Logically, yes, absolutely, they could have helped and they would have weakened those extremist elements. This speaks to a fundamental problem right now with U.S. policy, including its strategy vis-a-vis ISIS, which is what the United States has been trying to do is get allies in the region to act in a way to protect U.S. interests, including the ISIS threat, without actually addressing their main anxieties and concerns. Whether those are valid or not is a whole other question. But as the Gulf states see it, U.S. leadership is absent. The Sunni Arabs of the Levant and Iraq are being crushed. And until those things are addressed, they are not going to divert all their energy and resources to a problem that they see as a result of another problem that the United States has no intention of solving. If the United States wants the cooperation and a comprehensive strategy, A, the United States itself needs a strategy against ISIS. It's not at all clear to me that they have one. And secondly, that strategy needs to account for its allies' interests in order for them to be able to cooperate. And I think any strategy that does not create a fair order in which Sunni Arabs feel represented or can live with in Syria and Iraq, you're going to keep having ISIS in one form or the other perpetually.
Oh, very good point. Well, as we close, back to you, Jessica Lewis, to talk about the way forward. What you see is the preferred or advisable comprehensive strategy to help diffuse the situation. It seems, the way you've both painted the picture, very dire. Looking at disintegrating Iraq, not to say that it shouldn't be more decentralized, it's in the Constitution, it should be more, but it hasn't been in practice. And to what extent do we have to take into consideration Syria and Iraq if indeed we're to get stability in Iraq? And what do you think the U.S. role should be henceforth?
This is not just a terrorist threat anymore. ISIS is breaking down states. The major challenge is that in looking at this organization as a military enemy that can be defeated, it is not possible just to throw military might at it without having presence on the ground that is involved with the Sunni population on both sides.
You're not suggesting the United States send more troops than they have already sent. What does that entail?
The primary goal needs to be unifying a Sunni force to counter ISIS in northern and western Iraq, and that can be done a number of ways that don't necessarily involve an explicit number of troops, but very much as was mentioned, the political capital that the United States has with these groups at this point is probably limited. But if we are going to have a conversation about airstrikes to target this military enemy, that requires intelligence on the ground in order to make sure that airstrikes don't strike the wrong people. I think one of the options that is on the table that I think is most vulnerable is airstrikes without boots on ground, because it has the potential actually to alienate the Sunni population permanently and make it impossible for Iraq to recover.
So you're saying that the United States should even send more boots on the ground.
In order to pursue an airstrike option, yes.
Okay. Well, the last word to you, Faisal Itani, to try to make sense of what's going on in the way forward, how to combat ISIS, which seems to be really on the march. Is there any way that you see, politically, militarily, diplomatically, that the United States and those who want, you know, a stable area, both in Syria and Iraq, that can defuse the crisis?
As much as I don't have much sympathy for Maliki, I do still think the Iraqi state is redeemable, and that the regime in the very basic sense needs to be preserved. So I would agree with Jessica that the immediate priority is probably stopping their military momentum around Baghdad and taking the fight back to them in their core areas in Iraq. In Syria, however, I see as the best place to start a concerted effort to change the political, social, and military fabric of the Sunni Arab areas in the country. That is, I think, the ideal place to start diverting ISIS resources, killing their leadership, capturing their fighters, and basically demonstrating to these Sunni Arabs who are now trying to calculate which side to be on, that it's a losing bet and that there are alternatives, and that these alternatives are Sunni, or at least drawn from and approved by their own societies. And that requires a robust effort to arm, train, and finance the Syrian opposition, both to offset ISIS's resource advantage and to enable them to counter regime airstrikes in a manner that would free up resources against ISIS and allow some sort of semblance of governance to take hold in the Sunni territories in Syria. Short of that, I don't think that there is any way to permanently take care of the problem. And unlike in Iraq, I see the regime in Syria as having gone past the point of redemption, not worth saving, and unable to deliver the very basics of political governance, life, unity, and stability. So, you know, start where your enemy is weakest and you have allies, which, as I see it, is Syria.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Jessica Lewis, Research Director at the Institute for the Study of War, and Faisal Itani, Resident Fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Katie Espelita for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.